evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, March 15, 2017. The Speaker of South Sudan's Transitional National Legislative Assembly says the country has no money for the establishment of cantonment areas as required by the peace deal.
Lack of financial and logistical capacity to establish cantonment areas as it is required by the agreement. Economic capacity to establish economic downtown due to the impact of the war on oil production and the drop in the global oil prices.
And the head of the UN Commission on Human Rights says the human rights situation in South Sudan is very bad.
Whole villages burned to ashes, attacks on hospitals and churches, bodies dumped in rivers, allegations of young girls held as sexual slaves, women young and old gang raped, and boys and men forcibly recruited.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Salva Kiir's legal advisor is appealing to the governments in the regional bloc IGAD to support the implementation of the 2015 peace agreement. Lawrence Korbandi says South Sudan's instability could threaten security of the region. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Speaking at the start of a two-day Executive Council meeting of the Interparliamentary Union of IGAD States, Speaker Anthony Lino Makana appealed to regional leaders to help South Sudan address some of the many challenges it faces in implementing the peace deal.
Lack of financial and logistical capacity to establish cantonment areas as it is required by the agreement. Economic capacity to establish economic downtown due to the impact of the war on oil production and the drop in the global oil prices. The drought due to climatic change and now famine in parts of our country.
It has been 19 months since President Salva Kiir and former First Vice President Riek Machar signed the August 2015 peace agreement, which was violated by both sides within days. Violence continues to spread even to previously peaceful parts of the country. The SPLM-IO faction loyal to Machar declared the peace deal has collapsed. Lawrence Korbandi, a presidential advisor on legal affairs, acknowledges implementation is not proceeding well and asked IGAD members to support the peace process. He said if the challenges are not addressed, it could spread into a larger regional problem.
We have many challenges, and these challenges, we must come together and solve them. I think this is a genuine call, because the region as a whole faces big national security challenges, ranging from droughts and conflicts and economic crises and internal problems and name them. These are all constitute national security threats to our region in widest terms. Therefore, it is important for us to come together as you do today as parliamentarians.
At the two-day meeting here in Juba, lawmakers from IGAD member states are analyzing the challenges facing the region, especially in security. Korbandi warns the insecurity could affect other neighboring countries if not addressed. Atem Garang, a South Sudanese lawmaker participating in the meeting, says famine is just one of the big issues being addressed.
There is a famine which has been declared, and it's a hindrance. It's really a challenge to the implementation of the peace agreement. Also, the cantonment which was supposed to be established for the IO forces is not established due to lack of financial and logistics shortcomings. So, and some other issues like the declaration of national dialogue, which needs support from the region. So it should be an inclusive process.
Last month, three United Nations agencies declared a localized famine in two counties of the former Unity State, something they say is the result of a man-made tragedy, the more than 3.5-year conflict. Wake Simon Wudu, VOA News, Juba.
A new report presented to the UN Human Rights Council yesterday says the situation in South Sudan have gone from bad to worse in the last few months. The report is urging the council to investigate potential human rights violations in South Sudan's conflict. The chairman of the Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan, Yasmin Soka, added that a hybrid court should be operational in the country by the end of this year. Ayen Bior has more from Washington.
In a regular session of the Human Rights Council yesterday, Suka told observers that unlawful arrest and detentions, torture, rape and killings have become the norm in South Sudan.
And what's chilling is that they are occurring in many more parts of the country than before. Whole villages burned to ashes, attacks on hospitals and churches, bodies dumped in rivers, allegations of young girls held as sexual slaves, women young and old gang-raped, and boys and men forcibly recruited.
Suka is calling for an international impartial and independent investigation to be established by the United Nations to look into crimes committed in South Sudan. Suka said impunity is normal in South Sudan, and the mere knowledge that credible information is being gathered can act as a deterrent to future human rights violations. She says the hybrid court for South Sudan, as laid out in the 2015 peace agreement, should be operational by the end of the year. In the last 9 months alone, Suka says that there has been a massive increase in gross human rights violations and abuses, as well as an escalation in fighting in many parts of the country, putting millions of lives at risk.
The government has also conducted a brutal campaign of repression to silence civil society. Journalists who write about the daily suffering of South Sudanese citizens find themselves accused of being the enemy of the state. Civil society activists and their families are threatened. The Commission regrets that many UN and IGAD monitoring staff have been detained by National Security Service, some for nearly 3 years, despite repeated demands from the UN for access and their release. These are employees of international and regional bodies who have been accused of opposition sympathies and detained without charge.
South Sudanese officials repeatedly obstruct and manipulate humanitarians from reaching people in need, despite statements to the contrary, according to Suka. And she says the commission has found a pattern of ethnic cleansing and what she calls population engineering in South Sudan.
When the commission visited the northern town of Malakal, we saw how the redrawing of state boundary lines had helped depopulate the town of its Shulik and Nuer inhabitants. Civil servants had been forcibly relocated out of the town on the basis of their ethnicity. The commission has been subsequently told that a number of Dinka who fled Ye last year and settled around the airport in Juba were airlifted by the government to Malakal in February this year, just after the fighting emptied near Wout Shuluk of its Shuluk population.
Paulino Wanawila, South Sudan's Minister of Justice, says the commission's assessment overlooks the government's efforts to implement the 2015 peace deal, signed by the two warring parties and other representatives in South Sudan.
I would like to put forward the fact that the government of South Sudan to improve the human rights, the enjoyment of human rights by the people, has continued to cooperate, as I said. One of them is the acceptance of the regional protection force, which we are waiting for to arrive in Juba. Another one is evacuation of 400 houses in Juba and the collection of over 2,000 illegal arms from the people.
Despite the government's statement to the council that 2017 has been a year of peace and prosperity, Suka says, sadly, this is surreal in a country enduring one of Africa's worst wars. In the last month alone, she points out, there has been a serious escalation of fighting in parts of Greater Upper Nile and the Greater Equatoria region, with dire consequences for the civilian population. She notes that in recent months, at least 7 civilian officials and military commanders have resigned from their post, protesting the government's ethnic bias and tribalism. She says the hybrid court must be established immediately, and cases must be prosecuted. The alternative policy of appeasement, Suka warns, will, in her words, make the UN complicit in the bloodshed. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
As the UN warns about South Sudan's teetering on the edge of genocide, refugees describe the horrors that force hundreds of thousands of women and children to flee to Uganda. The humanitarian organization Save the Children says many kids are too traumatized to speak. The vice president of Save the Children, Craig Ram, tells VOA's Kim Lewis about the situation in South Sudan.
Well, South Sudan is facing both drought and conflict. We are very concerned about women being raped, women and children being killed, unending conflict that affects everybody but women and children the most. And it's sexual violence, it is physical abuse, it is quite horrific killing.
Children in particular, they're very traumatized to the point where they cannot even speak. So in this particular situation, what are some of the things that you all are doing to really help them?
When children are so traumatized that they can't speak, when young children have seen family members killed, the first thing to do is get them to a safe place, to a place where, in the very first instance, they can have enough food to eat and basic health care. But then Save the Children works at helping children restore their lives through child-friendly spaces, through caseworkers, talking to individual children, helping them find family who can care for them.
And I guess this would be the same in the situation where there was a 14-year-old who completed a 50-mile journey on foot while 8 months pregnant. So I guess she was heading from South Sudan going into Uganda?
Yes. So not only are there children and families displaced within South Sudan, but there are hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese refugees who have poured into Uganda. So on the Uganda side, Save the Children works alongside other agencies in the refugee camps with people who are trying to assist those who have fled. What we're trying to do is provide health care to help somebody like that, a 14-year-old pregnant girl who needs attention, needs prenatal care, who needs to have a space for safe delivery so that she and her baby can survive birth. We are talking about the absence in many places of even the most basic of medical care. And Save the Children is deeply concerned about how this conflict and how the drought have eliminated that basic care for, in this case, a 14-year-old girl who is 8 months pregnant.
And on top of these atrocities that are being committed against them, they are dealing with a situation of starvation. So this is something that just makes the matter even more urgent that the international community needs to respond. So what would you say then to the international community?
What Save the Children would say is that the very first instance, the conflict needs to come to an end and civilians need to be protected. But the world can't become numb to the suffering in South Sudan. 1 million children right now are at risk of starvation if they do not get nutritious food, if they do not get basic health care. Acute malnutrition is life-threatening. And what the world needs to do is to come together to help the people of South Sudan in their moment of need. Regardless of whatever is happening politically, children shouldn't have to suffer the war of adults.
Those that are making it to Uganda, what is the situation there like for them?
The good news is that everybody, including the Ugandan authorities, are working very hard to welcome and assist those in need who are arriving. The needs are quite acute. The challenge is that the numbers are overwhelming. Uganda now hosts more refugees than any other country in Africa, recently surpassing Ethiopia, which also hosts a huge number of refugees, including many from South Sudan. So the good news is that there is hope of assistance for refugees in Uganda. The difficult news is that the crisis is not getting international attention. We need far greater resources. The world needs to step and respond to what's happening in South Sudan and to the refugees in Uganda so that Save the Children and others can provide the life-saving assistance that is so desperately needed.
That's Craig Ram, Vice President of Humanitarian Response at Save the Children. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis in Washington. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at a new hospital in Kapoita. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today,
What do you think is the most important human right?
To me, the most important human right is for everyone to be given a fair trial, that is, those that are in court, so that they don't get punished for something that they did not commit.
The most important human right is the right to live, because God is the maker of human beings. So he has given you that opportunity. So you should have the freedom to move anywhere you want to. There's no restriction.
The freedom of speech that I think is when I have something which is burning within me, I have the right to tell you, do you think you are doing is wrong? When it's right, I will tell you the thing is right. And when you stop me from saying that, everything will get worse because you have neglected my right.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. Patients, health workers, and residents of Kapoita in Namur-Nyang State welcome the reopening of Kapoita Mission Hospital. It was shut down 6 months ago due to lack of funds. Catholic charity Caritas Torit received funds to run the hospital's operation for the next 3 years. As Dimon Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Torit, hospital administrators say doctors will now be able to perform fistula and eye surgeries at the hospital.
Kapoita residents dance and sing in the local Toposa language as the hospital reopened last week. Following the hospital's closure last September, a number of workers were laid off and hundreds of HIV and tuberculosis patients were cut off from health services. Caritas Torit, the charity that runs the Kapoita Mission Hospital, after receiving additional funding. Gilbert Osano is the Caritas Torit Health Coordinator.
We have now a one-year program supported by Caritas Luxembourg to provide three key services. One of it will be fistula repair. We are privy to the fact that in this greater Kapoita region and maybe up to Juba level, we don't have a specialized facility for fistula repair. This is to recognize the fact that we have or we could be having a lot of our women who could be suffering because of complications related to childbearing.
Kapoita resident Lohalia Marco is speaking in his native Toposa language, is grateful the facility has reopened.
During the closure, when the facility was not functioning, serious cases were around. Many people were very sick, so lives were lost, in fact, during the closure. But now, since it has been opened, at least that will fluctuate, will come down, will reduce.
Another Kapoita resident, Locharia Aikras, says the hospital's closure affected mostly tuberculosis patients who were unable to travel outside of Kapoita for medical care.
The TB cases were left under these sheds without food, without care. I can say many of them died. And the HIV cases who are weak to move out from this hospital had no attendance.
Osano says the hospital introduced other services, including an eye clinic and a nutritional center. The hospital also opened an eye clinic, something resident Locharia says will greatly benefit the pastoralist community.
There was an assessment of trachoma that was done here in 2015, which actually the prevalence of cataracts, the prevalence of this trachoma was captured along this belt of Greater Kapoita. And by introducing it to the mission, many cases have been going to Kenya, Uganda, others even turning blind because of lack of such a department around.
KG Betty, another Kapoita resident, says before the facility was reopened, people were miserable. Betty says many people who were sick could come from the village but would find the hospital closed. Betty says, as it is now open, they are very happy because they will not be going that far to seek medical care. Komake Tito, a clinical officer at the hospital, says TB and HIV patients were left untreated when the hospital closed.
Kapoita Mission Hospital was the only hospital offering these services,
Unfortunately, the nearest site is Torit State Hospital. So when the hospital was closed down, most of our patients defaulted their treatment, like the TB patients. Others even died, actually. So that was the most painful part of it.
Thomas Oleha Atia, the apostolic administrator of the Torit Catholic Diocese, says the church will try to make sure residents get the health services they need.
We did not forget the people. That is why we worked very hard to see that as soon as possible this hospital should be opened, and it is now. You are our people, and our thoughts have been always to you, our people in this area, in this region, to see that you get real services.
A number of aid agencies, including the IRIS, Aid Agency Cordiaid, Caritas Lusenbach, and Caritas Torit, are also helping to run the hospital. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit.
A new study shows teenage girls make up to 25% of new mothers in Cameroon hospitals. Muki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde on the problems these girls face.
2 months old Pride Nalova cries as her mother slaughters and roasts chicken in a restaurant in Cameroon's capital, Yaounde. Beatrice Nalova, the baby's 15-year-old mother, says she was forced to drop out of school when her mother found out that she was pregnant.
And when she took me to a nearby hospital, the doctor found out that I was 6 months pregnant. And my mother hid it from my father and tried to evacuate the pregnancy. So it didn't work. At last, I gave birth. And my father was surprised that I was pregnant. He drove me out of the house. He said it's something like a bad luck in the family. I left. I went and stayed with my aunt.
Beatrice was a student at Government Bilingual High School in Coleton in Yaounde. Philemon Enonchong, the school vice principal, says they do not allow pregnant girls to study alongside their peers in the school.
When we discover that a student is pregnant, we advise the parents to come and take the child back home. We will not just drive the child away or create a scene. When it's time for the exams, this child can come back and write.
The Cameroon Medical Council reports that 25% of pregnancies occur in girls of school age and 20% of pregnant teens do not return to school. Dr. Ndansi Elvis Noka with the Unite for Health Foundation, a group that fights unwanted pregnancies and abortions, says the council's figures may be low because less than 30% of the population visit conventional health services.
Their fear is a fear of parental ostracization, like my mom is going to kill me, my dad is going to slaughter me, what are my friends going to think about me? But 25% is what government has identified based on those who have already overcome the fear of parents, the fear of friends, the fear of teacher.
Contraceptives are still taboo in most communities and poverty levels are still very high, forcing many girls into prostitution. The country's demographic health survey adds that traditional practices which encourage early marriages, especially in the Muslim-dominated northern regions, are also responsible for teenage pregnancies. Psychologist Miren Jenje says the increase in teenage pregnancies also is linked to increased communication and interaction between peoples.
On est à une période où le monde est carrément ouvert.
She says this is a period when the world is completely a global village and people can communicate and even see themselves at all moments and wherever they are. She says adolescent girls have a greater challenge because they are exposed to the internet and social media, which have videos that entice them to try having sexual relations. Gynecologist Vivian Verbe-Sally of Cameroon's Ministry of Health says severe bleeding, infections, and high blood pressure before and after birth are some complications that cause death during childbirth among girls under the age of 15. She did not have statistics on how many teenagers die while giving birth.
When a little girl gets pregnant at that age,
She is likely to have what you call an obstructed labor because of a small pelvis. And because of that, if she's not having the baby in a center where the staff is qualified to identify that on time and do a C-section to save the baby, she will likely have what you call vesicovaginal fistula.
The World Health Organization says teenage pregnancies constitute a serious health and social problem worldwide, most of them occurring in low and middle income countries. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Once South Sudan's lengthy conflict finally ends, the work of rebuilding the country's infrastructure, institutions, and physical policy begins. That kind of work is at times performed without consideration of the needs of women and girls. A panel at the U.S. Institute of Peace here in Washington said post-conflict reconstruction presents an opportunity to address structural gender inequality. Ian Bior has more from Washington.
Decisions on land reform, agricultural policies, and building roads may seem like technical decisions that have very little to do with women's rights. But Carol Cohn, director of the Consortium on Gender, Security, and Human Rights at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and a panelist at Tuesday's USIP Forum, says decisions on building infrastructure could have a direct impact on women's development.
Whether you're talking about roads, bridges, mobility, energy, water, the decisions that get made about how to do this will affect the possibilities for women's livelihoods. They will affect women's care burdens. They will affect how they spend their time, whether or not they are physically secure, whether or not they even have the time to participate in political and economic life.
Cohn says thinking of women's issues as a separate set of issues could undermine the work of ensuring gender equality, as well as women and girls' development.
We can't continue to think about gender equality as a separate series of programs and initiatives, things that often get called women around women's issues, as they're called. When it is thought about as a separate series of programs and initiatives, they are inevitably small. They are almost inevitably not quite seen as important enough. Oh, we have to address the urgent stuff first and we can deal with these things later.
Janet Stotsky, an economist and visiting scholar with the International Monetary Fund in Washington, who was also at the forum, says practicing gender budgeting could ensure that fiscal policy promotes gender equality and girls' and women's development.
Gender budgeting is not all about just taking money from the budget to give to women's programs. It's about spending money better to achieve national development goals that will benefit your whole society. It's not a zero-sum game, and it's not just about reallocating money in the budget to benefit some at the expense of others. Gender budgeting should address any valid national development goals that will benefit your whole society.
Issues like land reform, land acquisition, and monetary policy are all post-reconstruction issues that should be taken into account at the same time gender equality is tackled, according to Cohn.
All of the processes that are part of post-conflict reconstruction and peace building are themselves gendered. They have deeply gendered effects. They have the possibility of leaving gendered and other structural inequalities in place, or of actually deepening them or transforming them.
Cohn says if policymakers are not thinking about state building in terms of how they affect women's development, they are not improving women's security, and the country could lose out on the transformative effects that are part of a peace agreement, such as the one signed by the warring parties in South Sudan. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Pretty Girl by the Rhymers. We have been listening to the test of that song by the Rhymers. The title is Pretty Girl. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being here. We will meet you back here tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Make some love and don't let me.